411 Live.
Well, you can learn about issues that affect us every day.
Real people, real talk.
Made to help people in our community in every way. For your girl, 411 Live.
Hello, I'm Beverly Taylor, and this is the 411 Live. Real people, real talk. Guess what? We've just hit another milestone. Praise the Lord. Season 8 is officially in the books, and you know we're always excited to celebrate our achievements. Now it's time to dish out some highlights from the completed season. We're serving up snippets from all 20 episodes. And in our last two podcasts, we took a trip down memory lane with episodes 1 through 14. But hold on tight, because in this final installment, we're keeping the review going strong. Get ready for a mix of topics covering important issues in our community, introducing you to some incredible people, and dropping knowledge that might just make an impact in your life. Let's get started. Episode 15, Clean Slate MKE, providing second chances through pardons and expungements in Wisconsin. In this episode, we sit down with Chanyelle McLeod, the visionary behind Clean Slate MKE, to explore the world of criminal record expungement and pardons. The spotlight is on the transformative power of expungements, offering individuals with low-level offenses a shot at rebuilding their lives without the burden of a criminal record. We uncover the hurdles faced by those with criminal records and delve into McLeod's personal journey, showcasing how she turned her own experience into a force for positive change. Throughout the discussion, we navigate the critical distinctions between expungements and pardons, and sharing real-life success stories that illuminate the profound transformations possible with a second chance.
You know, once I found out what expungement was, I seen it as an opportunity to get what I thought was my life back. Mm-hmm. And in return, it gave me a whole new life because it put me in place to serve other people and help other people with getting a second chance and getting a fresh start, even if it meant I couldn't.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's amazing to me some of the things that we feel our pitfalls, things that have had just a detrimental impact in our lives. And then we discover that we can use that experience to help others.
Correct.
And that's what you're doing.
And I didn't see it that way in the beginning.
Yeah.
I was just trying to learn the ropes, which led me into, you know, being a paralegal in the first place, trying to learn how to read the law, because the law is not a very easy thing to read and comprehend and apply, you know.
Yeah.
So once I learned how to be a paralegal, I went and interned at Legal Action, and I learned the step-by-step process of how to do an expungement and, you know, get rid of that criminal record, at least from CCAP, to increase the, you know, opportunities for employment, housing, education, and the other things that prevent people from moving forward with them.
Right,
with their
and CCAP being the Wisconsin court system website.
That's correct.
That everybody goes to.
That's right. Everybody goes to CCAP and CCAP people. It's an invasion of privacy is what it really is. And it, you know, but it stopped me from, like you just said before, I remember sitting in manpower, passing all the tests. You know, they give you all these tests. And as soon as I get to the desk, she already got CCAP up. And she's shaking her head no. And I needed that job.
Wow.
When I say I needed that job, I'm talking about two months behind on rent. You know,
yeah.
We energies need their money. I needed that job. And so I remember I was sitting at the desk at the job center, and this guy was like, you know, I'm crying. I'm talking about I slipped into a deep state of depression. I have never known poverty in my life, you know. So I'm sitting at the desk, and this guy was like, what's wrong? Why are you crying? And I told him, and he said, it sounded like you need your record expunged. And then, boom.
That was it.
That light bulb went off for me in 2007, and I have not been off of it ever since.
So you took the route of paralegal seeking, you know, that avenue because of this?
That's correct.
Because you hadn't thought about this before.
No, I was in corporate. Like, if I would have never lost my job in corporate America, I honestly probably still would have been there. Yeah. I had no reason to come into this area of my life. I'd never been in jail before. I've never been in jail since then. I'm not a criminal. Mm-hmm. But once you get that record, you're labeled a criminal. And when people see CAP you, that's all they see. That's all they see is that one occurrence that you've done, and now it's like your brand and it's like your label, and they don't see past that. When it comes to applying to certain corporate jobs or even, you know, the education entity, the banking industry, that record carries more weight than your resume.
Wow.
It does.
You know, we were talking before, and you were saying that it affects women more than anything else.
It does.
Because what? Women are going to those jobs, seeking those
entities.
Jobs.
That's right. So think about it like this. People would think about mass incarceration, they think about men. But when it comes to criminal records and seeking opportunity, men particularly go into the skilled trades. They're mechanics, they're plumbers, they're electricians. I'm not saying that women can't be, but for the most part, when the last time a mechanic, you need to hire a mechanic, did you ask about his criminal record? No, because if he can start that car, he got the job.
That's all you care about.
That's all you care about, you know? But women, and then they're entrepreneurs. Most men, they are entrepreneurs. They got a record. They go and start selling stuff. They start car shops. They go into trucking, automotive. The automotive industries and the trucking industries don't care about your criminal record. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They care about driving record, yes. Criminal record, no. It's the flip side with women. When women, for the most part, we're nurturers. We're going into the cares industry, health care, child care, elder care, all in which your background is on the forefront. The education industries, like I said before, the banking industries, all on the forefront. When it comes to getting that position, they're going to look at your background first. And if you can't pass those, you can't get clearances, and you can't get, you know, past the licensing boards and stuff, like, it's not happening.
Yeah.
It's not happening. It's an automatic bar. And it doesn't matter how old that record is. I talked to many women who have had, you know, food stamp fraud, you know what I'm saying, from 1990s and AFDC. You know what I'm saying? We don't even use the term AFDC no more. That just shows how old the record is. But those records still play a role in seeking opportunities. It still does.
Wow. Okay. So Clean Slate MKE, what are you doing?
So I'm a paralegal. I've been a paralegal for 13 years now. And so we do doc prep. Thank you. So we do doc prep. For the most part, we prepare documentation for people who are eligible to have their records expunged or are seeking to get their rights back, also known as a pardon. So let's just say we get somebody, we vet them to see if they're even qualified to have their record expunged. And in the event that they are, we help them with the process. The expungement process can be quite complicated and expensive. And for people in the inner city of Milwaukee that are low income.
Episode 16, Breaking Barriers, Nia Boateng's diverse triathlete book series for kids. I chat with the incredible Nia Boateng, an award-winning author. We'll delve into her latest book series, Exploring All You Can Do, which focuses on diverse young athletes. Nia spills the beans on what inspired her to create the series and how she picked the sports featured in each book. We'll also dive into the significance of representation in children's literature and the positive impact her books have had on readers. The series covers a range of sports, including triathlon, hockey, snowboarding, skiing, and fencing. You have an aura. You bring positivity. You know, you have the infectious smile and laugh. And I was like, well, she's just going to brighten up the room, you know? And then to talk about all the things that you've been doing since a year and a half ago is great. You know, with this new series, you kind of continue the triathlete vein of it, but with different sports.
Yes.
How did you choose these? So let's talk about what the sports are and how you chose them.
I know. Well, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to speak with you as well. It's always nice to be here at the 411. And yes, and so actually when I wrote my first book, I had the second one already in mind.
Okay.
Only because I ski. And so originally, you know, I've skied for 20 plus years, a lot longer than I've been a triathlete. I've been a triathlete now for about this year will be my 10th year being a triathlete. And so the ski and snowboarding book was already kind of boiling in my brain about, come on now, girlfriend, you were skiing and snowboarding for a while. You got to do a ski and snowboarding book. And I wanted to do one that had a grandmother. Actually, the triathlete one actually had a grandmother in it. And I reduced it down because when I went to my illustrator, he was going to charge me more to have more characters in the book. And so it became this book about a young girl's journey.
Okay.
And so it was kind of singular in that sense. And some of it's really inspired by my own story and struggles of swimming and other things. And I kind of put that into the book, but really wanted people to write their own story.
Mm-hmm.
And so how can I tell people to write their own story when, you know, I have all these other stories brewing inside of me?
Yeah.
And so the ski and snowboarding was next. And then I've always liked fencing. I've always thought it was elegant and beautiful.
You don't see it. It's not highlighted a lot or in my sphere, I guess. So I was surprised to see that one.
I know. Well, my thing is, why not?
Yeah.
You know? So my new series, you know, I wanted to do something that I felt was impactful.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to show us in different ways. And so I wanted to highlight sports that, you know, that I've enjoyed, but I haven't seen a lot.
Episode 17, The Courage to Stand Up, a 95-year-old's journey from Alabama to Milwaukee. In this one, we dive into the incredible journey of a 95-year-old legend, William Waddleton. Picture this. Growing up in Alabama, his family co-founded the self-governed black municipality of Hobson City. And he joined the Army and eventually found his way to Milwaukee. This man's got stories. Mr. Waddleton spills the beans on his involvement in a lawsuit that shook things up, bringing significant changes in workers' rights and opportunities in Wisconsin. Throughout our chat, we'll get a glimpse of his resilience, activism, and the unshakable faith he has in making positive changes in the world. You got in Laddish, you're working there, and you noticed some disparities.
Mm-hmm.
What did you see?
I happened to get to Laddish. My brother's father-in-law was working in. I was looking for a job. And I had applied for the fire department. Nobody had called me, and I needed a job. So I had gotten married. I didn't finish school. I didn't finish Marquette either. But I had a lot of experience by working as a student at Marquette. And then I got a job at Laddish. Now, me and my friend, Edward Thomas, we took the test at the same time, and he got called before I did. And so what he did, I went to Laddish, and in 2 days I made more money than he did, and he worked for a whole month. So
tell me what happened when you saw the pay at Laddish.
I walked around and seen a lot of people, young guys, and they were making $300 a week. And I learned how the white guy was making $1,100, $1,200 a week and $1,800 a week. And I couldn't figure it out. How come they making so much and they doing the same kind of job?
Right.
And so what happened? I went around and talked to several guys. I said, man, you know how much you know how much that guy make? That guy made more money than you do, about three times as much money you do. You know what, man, we should do something about that. So I kept talking to different guys, and so after I got the guys together, I got a number of guys together, and I told them to meet me at the YMCA on 12th Street. We went to 12th Street, so I talked to all of them. I told them about some of the things, a lot of things they didn't know. And so I had found it out, so I had went to another lawyer, Dr. Dale. He was a civil rights lawyer downtown. He told me a lot of things. We had another meeting, and I got all the guys together, and it was 257 guys at Lattice, and I was able to get 127 of them together.
Oh, wow.
Half of them didn't believe what we were going to do, and, you know, some of them, you know, like some of this.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our review of Season 8 of the 411 Live.
Might not see it coming. It's pre-diabetes, and it captures 1 in 3 adults. But you can escape. Take the 1-minute pre-diabetes risk test to know where you stand and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. Be your own hero on smartphones everywhere at doihaveprediabetes.org.
Hi. I'm your retirement fear. But don't be scared. You're still in pre-retirement.
Does that mean I have more time to plan?
Precisely. Here, this is pretirement.org.
Retirement savings options? Potential tax breaks?
Ooh.
This isn't scary. I'm doing it.
You got this.
Visit thisispretirement.org for free resources to help you customize your action plan.
Welcome back. We are reviewing Season 8 of the 411 Live, and we're at Episode 18. We called it Grief and Resiliency, a Mother-Daughter Perspective. My guest, Janine Hibbler, and her daughter, Sanaya. Now, these two know what grief is by experience. Janine's husband died of a heart attack during the peak of the pandemic, and her son committed suicide. Oh, and her father died, too. All of this happening in less than a year. They both open up about the struggles, coping, and moving forward. Their journey is truly remarkable, leading Janine to start an organization that supports other widows.
I remember when the guidance counselor who was taking me there, because they had sent the guidance counselor to come get me, which also does not happen very often, so I knew something was a little bit wrong. And then when I finally got to the office, it was my father, my other brother, Gerald, the youngest, and then my uncle and my older sister. And so obviously I knew something was going on. And then the SRO was also there. So I was like, oh, my gosh, what is happening?
Yeah.
So thankfully they made sure that they had me out of the building before they actually like told me what had happened. Mm-hmm. And of course, that was a very stressful day because, I mean, at first I knew mom was on a business trip. So I thought something had happened to her. But then when they finally told me that it was my brother, yeah, of course you have that immediate heart drop and that disbelief at first. You're like, no, that can't be actually what happened. Mm-hmm. I need a different explanation for this. But then when that finally, you know, settles in and you get that acceptance, which it doesn't happen immediately. Sometimes it takes days, sometimes it takes months, years and stuff like that. And it definitely did take a while for me to finally like accept the fact that he's gone. He's not coming back. I was constantly sitting at home waiting for him to come back from work or waiting for him to come back. And obviously he wasn't there. And then flash forward to when my grandfather passed. That was another one that like I had a lot of disbelief with that one as well, because we didn't live in the home with my grandfather, but my grandmother was living with us. And so, just having to be kind of just sat down and told what happened, it was a lot more just slowly, a slower release of the information. I felt it was very abrupt when my brother passed away and they just kind of said it to me straight, which I think me now, I would have been able to handle it a lot better than I did back then. But obviously being 13 years old and being at school and not being able to say that last goodbye and all that, it was a little bit harder. I think it was great to have that kind of final closure, though, because my last moment with my brother wasn't bad.
Right.
He was wishing me off for school. He was being kind. He was being loving, as we know him to be. And so I think that very much helped me kind of go through the motions and deal with things a little bit better. And then when my father passed away, that was the only one that I was present for. And for me, I actually... I carried a lot of guilt with that one.
Why?
Because after the pandemic kind of like struck and everybody was indoors and stuff, we were having church services outside. And we were attending regularly, obviously, as First Lady and children and stuff. But after a while, I think carrying the weight of what happened with my older brother started to hit me, and I stopped coming to church. And so I wasn't there to hear him preach his last sermon. I was at home. And so I obviously felt bad already, but I remember, I think I had went to use the bathroom. The way that our house is set up is that all of our rooms are in a hallway, and my parents' bedroom is right next to mine. Mine's at the end of the hall, and theirs is kind of right on the corner right there. And I had walked past the room, and I saw my father laying there, but I thought he was asleep.
Oh, okay.
So, of course, you can imagine what I felt when mom comes into my room and tells me that he, in fact, was not. So I think I carried a lot of guilt from that, thinking it was somehow my fault that I didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. Like, and obviously, they tell you not to blame yourself and stuff, which is much easier said than done.
Right.
But yeah, it just, it takes time, and it takes acceptance is the word that I mainly use. Once you learn to accept things and kind of just know that this is how it happens, we all have a day to be born, we have our days to live, and then we have our days where that comes to an end. So, yeah, I think just acceptance and being very honest with myself and just letting myself not only feel things, but just letting myself just have an understanding of things. Because I think when you go through these things at such a younger age, obviously, I think there's some growing up that needs to be done in that process for sure. Because you may think that part of your childhood has been taken away, having to go through something so deep, especially having these three tragedies happen in a 10-month period where it was like I didn't even get a time to rest before the next and the next.
Yes.
So,
Episode 19, Building a Better Future, A Journey of Self-Love and Healing. In this insightful conversation, we dive into the powerful journey of breaking generational cycles and curses by prioritizing mental health and emotional well-being. The commitment is clear, preventing the transmission of negative patterns to the next generation. Joining me are two incredible guests, Sarah Newman, the visionary owner of Rise Youth and Family Services and founder of Project Mosaic, and Ebony Reeves, who is currently being coached by Sarah. Together, they unravel the pivotal role of self-care and mental health in achieving success across various aspects of life. The discussion emphasizes the importance of encouragement, setting boundaries, and having someone to listen. So, Ebony, when you started this process, where were you and where are you now?
Okay.
So what's your story, I guess I'm asking?
So I was on my self-love and healing journey when we were connected. So I felt to implement her was perfect because I needed that extra. I didn't know how to get to where I wanted to get to. Mm-hmm. So with the help of Sarah, I really learned a lot about self-care and the importance of mental health and just staying on top of that, because if I don't stay on top of that, I cannot continue to be an honor roll student. I cannot run my household. I cannot take care of my children. And I'm real big on breaking generational cycles and curses.
Right.
That was my main thing. I wanted to learn to manage my emotions better and break generational curses so that my children, you know, can break those things, and so that they're not even connected to it, so that when they start having children, they can do things in healthy ways. So where I am now, I think we're all a work in progress still, but I think I know that if it weren't for Sarah and her resources, that I probably would kind of have like a dark cloud over me, because mm-hmm. I was unaware of her program and I was unaware of the knowledge that I've been learning from her. Right. And Sarah's really big on reminding you of how far you've come and, like, Ebony, you accomplished this. And I am learning to celebrate even the small things.
Yes.
Because I'll tell Sarah, like, hey, I got 4.0 this semester. And I'll kind of, to me, that's what I'm supposed to do. So I don't go like, oh, yay. And she was like, that's awesome. And it's like she's more excited than
right.
me. So I'm learning to celebrate the big, the small, the in-betweens, because, you know, I'm an awesome person and I've come a long way.
I like that. I'm an awesome person. I heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. So, you know, you were talking about generational curses. First of all, are you, where are you in this, you know, you said 4.0.
So I'm a student at MATC.
Okay.
I'm majoring in criminal justice to become a victims' right advocate for domestic violence and sexually abused women and children. Mm-hmm. So I graduate in May.
Oh, wow.
So this is my third semester.
Episode 20, the final episode of season 8, unveiling the hidden realities of child welfare and homelessness. This time around, we're shining a spotlight on the critical issues of homelessness and racial disparities within the child welfare system. In this eye-opening discussion, I had the privilege of chatting with Amara Morales, a dedicated family advocate, and Lincoln Rice, the author of The Ethics of Protection. Together, they illuminate the impactful work of Casa Maria Catholic Worker. That's an organization providing housing for women with children. We're delving deep into the challenges faced by this specific group, particularly women with children who grapple with the difficulty of finding emergency shelter and the risk of having their kids taken from them.
This was the first case that really made me wake up to the issue. Mm-hmm. So this was a few years ago at Casa Maria. There was a mother staying there that she had a 15-year-old daughter. And just if it's always unfair to judge parenting by children, but if you could, this daughter was one of the nicest teenagers we've ever had stay. So helpful, so compassionate, helping other kids out with their homework, helping people, you know. So, but she had these triplets that were just shy of the time that you'd start giving them hard food. And they got the flu and they had a fever and they were vomiting everything. And a couple days into this, just out of desperation, she tried giving the triplets some hard food, a little bit of chicken. Mm-hmm. And they vomited that up also. And then the following day, she brought them to Children's Hospital, you know, and what she thought was the case was the case. They had the flu. They made sure that the kids got enough fluids and gave them some medicine to bring the fever down. And they said the kids are going to be fine. But then the doctor said, but, you know, I thank you for your forthrightness and letting me know everything that you tried. But feeding the children chicken was inappropriate, and I need to report that to Child Protective Services.
Wow.
And, you know, this woman and her children are African American, and I just have a difficult time believing that if this was a white mother coming down from River Hills, that this doctor calls Child Protective Services on her. And then the CPS investigator came to Casa Maria, believed that this was an unsafe situation for the triplets, and removed them. Again, if this was a mother in River Hills, I don't think these children get removed. And so, as I point out in the book, the average amount of time it takes a mother to be reunified, if that's what happens, is about 22 months. And that's almost exactly how long it took her to get her triplets back. But if we hadn't been able to give her a space, because as Amara pointed out, all of the court cases needing to go to a third place to meet with your kids regularly to show that you actually want to be with them. Because of her situation of homelessness, she wasn't able to hold down a job and fulfill all of her conditions because she needed to be readily available all the time. So, it was just a heartbreaking case. And
And no one's really factoring the separation.
By the way, someone sent us the topic for that last episode via our website, the411live.org. So if you have an idea for a podcast, please let us know. And that concludes the three-part look back at the 20 episodes of Season 8 of the 411 Live. Wow, we covered a lot. A huge thank you to all the wonderful guests and for the viewers and listeners. We now start Season 9. I hope you will tune in. Feel free to let us know how we're doing through our website. Go there if you'd like to support our nonprofit endeavors as well. I'm Beverly Taylor, and this is the 411 Live. Real people, real talk. God bless. If you would like to check out past episodes, there are many ways. Go to your favorite podcast platform. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Like and watch us on Facebook. Watch and subscribe to our YouTube channel. And if you have suggestions for future episodes, go to our website, the411live.org. We'll be right back.